Welcome to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This week is episode 18, Dr. Crumpler's Trailblazing Career. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. We are back from Iceland and ready to continue celebrating Black History Month. This week, we're going to talk about a woman who studied medicine at a time when very few women could access higher education at all, and an African American who became a physician at a time when half of this country believed that she could be owned by another American. Rebecca Lee would study in Boston and become America's first Black female doctor. But before we meet Dr. Rebecca Davis Lee Crumpler, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is February 27th, and on February 27th, 1776, George Washington was preparing for what he hoped would be a final battle to drive the British out of occupied Boston. He wrote a letter to Philip Schuyler, the father of Angelica, Eliza, and Peggy, the Schuyler sisters.
Angelica,
work, work.
Eliza,
and Peggy,
work, work. The Schuyler sisters,
Angelica,
Peggy,
Eliza,
work.
At that point, Schuyler was general of the Continental Army's Northern Department. Washington described what he hoped to accomplish with the cannons that Henry Knox had taken from Fort Ticonderoga, which was under Schuyler's command. We have just completed a large and strong work on Lechmere's Point, opposite to New Boston, and are about to take post on the heights of Dorchester, with a view of drawing the enemy out. These heights will command a large part of town and almost the whole harbor, and give us an opportunity of distressing the enemy whenever we may be properly provided with necessaries for carrying on a cannonade and bombardment. If anything will induce General Howe to risk an engagement, it will be this. I am determined to do everything in my power to bring one on, and that as soon as possible. How far my views may be answered, time must determine. General Howe and his British forces evacuated Boston about 3 weeks later.
The art of vaudeville was born in Boston on February 28, 1883, when the nation's first vaudeville theater opened on Washington Street in the heart of today's theater district. The Bijou Theater was the brainchild of Benjamin Franklin Keith. Keith was originally from New Hampshire, and he had been a grifter, traveling carnival barker, and New York dime museum promoter before settling down in Boston. He first opened a dime museum where, as the name implies, guests would pay a dime to see novelties such as a tattooed man or a real-life mermaid, which, of course, was always just a bad taxidermy job. When he opened the Bijou in 1883, he was attempting to bridge the gap between lowbrow entertainment like that found in his dime museum and more highbrow entertainment like the legitimate theater. He booked acts that would become the standard for vaudeville for the next half century. There were quick back-to-back skits, a tap dancing man, then a family of singers, a dog riding a bike, and a juggler or plate spinner, all moving through quickly without giving the audience a chance to get bored. The form would become one of the most popular entertainments in America until the motion picture came to dominance in the 30s. As vaudeville took off, Keith insisted on running cleaned-up Boston versions of popular shows, with the vulgarity and suggestiveness stripped out. This both fit with Boston's puritanical public image and allowed Keith to rake in plenty of profits, as his theater was one of the few considered appropriate for women and children to frequent. Unfortunately, the Bijou could not meet the new fire codes put into place after the 1942 Coconut Grove fire, and it was forced to close. The building was torn down in 1951, but the facade still stands between the Paramount Theater and the Boston Opera House. We'll link to an article about Benjamin Franklin Keith that includes pictures of his Bijou Theater in this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/018.
Wednesday is March 1st, and that's the date in 1797 when Abigail Adams wrote this letter to John just a few days before he was inaugurated as America's second president. While John was away from home doing the nation's business in Europe, and in New York and Philadelphia serving in the government, Abigail was left in charge of the family farm in Quincy, sometimes for years at a time. In this letter, she updates the soon-to-be president of her plans for the upcoming growing season. My dearest friend, several things which I have written upon, and which I wish for directions before I proceeded to execute, are, I suppose, lost and forgotten by you in the multitude of your thoughts. I must proceed. Vinton's time is near out. There is an apprisement of the stock which must be made. A mate is to be procured for the ox we lost. I tell French he ought to buy it, as he expects a further indulgence with the team. I believe I wrote you that I had hired a young man for a month, a son of Samuel Brackett, who went from this town some years ago. He's very capable of business, but holds himself very high. I shall be a better judge of the qualities of Brackett at the expiration of a month. He is large and stout, used to a team, of good stock himself, brought up to labor now, and is now sought after by several persons for the season. But gold may be bought too dear. Prices are not settled until April and May. There are more notes on family and politics. Then she closes the letter. I shall now take leave of the vice president and address my next letters to the president, whom neither rank or station can more permanently fix in the heart of his ever affectionate, Abigail Adams.
In a report on public roads and canals commissioned by the U.S. Senate on March 2, 1807, Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin described the Middlesex Canal. The canal opened in 1802 and connected Boston Harbor at Charlestown with the Merrimack River in Lowell. Gallatin said, "The Middlesex Canal, uniting the waters of that river with the harbor of Boston, is, however, the greatest work of the kind which has been completed in the United States. That canal, 12 feet wide and 3.5 feet deep, draws its supply of water from Sudbury or Concord River, a branch of the Merrimack, and from the summit ground extends 6 miles, with a descent of 28 feet, to the Merrimack above Pawtucket Falls, and 22 miles, with a descent of 107 feet, to the tidewater of the harbor of Boston. The descent to the Merrimack is effected by 3, and that to the tidewater by 19 locks. They are all 90 feet long, 12 feet wide, of solid masonry and excellent workmanship. In order to open that canal, it was necessary to dig in some places at the depth of 20 feet, to cut through ledges of rocks, to fill some valleys and morasses, and to throw several aqueducts across the intervening rivers. All those obstacles have been overcome, and boats of 24 tons, 75 feet long and 11 feet wide, can navigate the canal. Those in most general use are of smaller dimensions and are drawn by 2 horses at the rate of 3 miles an hour. Common boats pass from one end of the canal to the other in 12 hours. Listeners to the podcast know what an infrastructure geek I am, so that report's music to my ears. If you'd like to read the whole thing, we'll have a link in the show notes at hubhistory.com/018.
On March 3rd, 1729, the members of Boston's Third Congregational Society began tearing down their church. The Cedar Meeting House, as it was known, was built by dissenters from Boston's first church in 1670. By 1729, the congregation had outgrown their meeting house and began a contentious debate over whether to tear it down to build a new church. Reverend Joseph Sewell and his allies prevailed, and the old building came down after one last Sabbath service, which was full to overflowing. After tearing down the structure, it was found that the support beams were so rotted out that it was practically miraculous that the building didn't collapse during the final service. After the ground was cleared, a new brick building went up. We know it today as Boston's Old South Meeting House.
Saturday is March 4th, which is the 388th anniversary of the founding of Massachusetts. On March 4th, 1629, King Charles I signed a document that began, "Charles, by the grace of God, King of England, Scotland, France, and Ireland, defender of the faith, etc., to all whom these presents shall come, greeting." He then goes on to make a grant of all that part of New England in America aforesaid, which lies and extends between a great river there commonly called Merrimack, and a certain other river there called Charles River, being in the bottom of a certain bay there commonly called Massachusetts Bay, and also all those lands lying within the space of 3 English miles on the south part of the said Charles River, and also all the lands lying and being within the space of 3 English miles to the southward of the southernmost part of the said bay called Massachusetts, and also all those lands which be within the space of 3 English miles to the northward of the said river called Merrimack, from the Atlantic Sea on the east part to the South Sea on the west part. With this royal charter, the Massachusetts Bay Colony was founded. We'll have an image and transcription of the original charter in the show notes this week at hubhistory.com/018. If you're interested, you can see the original 1629 charter and the 1691 charter of William and Mary in the Commonwealth Museum in Dorchester.
And finally, Sunday is March 5th. On March 5th, 1776, the 6th anniversary of the Boston Massacre, the Continental Army took control of the strategic hills on Dorchester Neck, overlooking occupied Boston. A British officer wrote in a letter home that day, "This is, I believe, likely to prove as important a day to the British Empire as any in our annals. We underwent last night a very severe cannonade, which damaged a number of houses and killed some men. This morning, at daybreak, we discovered two redoubts on the hills on Dorchester Point and two smaller works on their flanks. They were all raised during the night with an expedition equal to that of the genie belonging to Aladdin's wonderful lamp. From these hills, they command the whole town, so that we must drive them from their post or desert the place. The former is determined upon, and five regiments are already embarked. This may be looked upon as the opening of the campaign. It is worthwhile to remark with what judgment the leaders of the rebels take advantage of the prejudices and work upon the passions of the mob. The 5th of March is the anniversary of what they call the Bloody Massacre, when in, I think, 1769, it was actually 1770, the king's troops fired upon the people in the streets of Boston. If ever they dare stand against us, it will be today. But I hope tomorrow to be able to give you an account of their defeat." Then the next day he updates the letter. "A wind more violent than anything I ever heard prevented our last night's purposed expedition and so saved the lives of thousands. Today they have made themselves too strong to make a dislodgement possible. We are under their fire whenever they choose to begin, so that we are now evacuating the town with the utmost expedition and leaving behind us half our worldly goods. Adieu. I hope to embark in a few hours." The evacuation would get underway with favorable winds on March 17th.
Wow, there were a lot of important milestones this week in Boston history. But before we discuss Dr. Crumpler, let's take a look at the New England Female Medical College, the oldest medical school in the U.S. exclusive to women. The college had its roots in the Female Education Society, which opened in Boston in 1848 for the medical education of women. The Female Medical Education Society aimed to establish a medical school and teaching hospital in Boston that would teach women midwifery and nursing so they could treat women and children. Although it was a time when most people couldn't fathom the idea of a female doctor, the foundation of the college was accepted by many as it provided women with a socially sanctioned position in a feminized occupation. Midwifery, that is. On May 27, 1857, by an act of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the name was changed to the New England Female Medical College, and the school was reorganized. Let's be frank. The premise for the school is rooted in sexism, in a belief that male physicians shouldn't generally assist in childbirth. Founder Samuel Gregory saw male midwifery as unnatural and improper, and believed that women should be educated to become certified midwives and attend to their own sex. In gathering support, Gregory argued that the U.S. was the only country in the world where women were dependent on men for aid in childbirth, and that male midwives caused unnecessary embarrassment to women. He advocated for midwifery to become a feminine occupation exclusively in the hands of women, and they could handle it. After all, midwifery was a simple mechanical routine beneath the male physicians, who should be happy to hand it off to women and be able to dedicate their time to other medical fields where they could more fully employ their mental capacities.
Okay, but I've seen a lot of babies delivered on TV, including those delivered by Dr. Michaela Quinn, medicine woman, also from Boston. And it seems like things sometimes really go wrong in childbirth.
Well, that's a fair point, but there's more. Gregory also believed that females would be more likely to avoid using drugs and medical instruments during childbirth, and instead allow for nature to run its course while just comforting patients, which he thought would lead to fewer fatalities during childbirth.
Well, despite that sound logic, the college did eventually expand to include a more robust curriculum. The program included a year of classes and then a two-year apprenticeship with a final thesis and exam. And throughout its 27 years, over 300 women attended classes and 98 received doctoral degrees. In 1873, Boston University merged with the New England Female Medical College, becoming the first accredited co-educational medical school in the U.S. With that background on the medical college, let's turn to Dr. Crumpler. Admittedly, not much is known about her. She was born Rebecca Davis to free parents in Delaware on February 8, 1831. But she grew up in Pennsylvania, being cared for by an aunt who provided some type of nursing care to her own patients. Rebecca excelled in school and secured a spot at a prestigious private school, the West Newton English and Classical School in Newton, Massachusetts. The school was one of the first racially integrated schools in the country and taught boys and girls in co-ed classrooms. After graduating in 1852, she moved to Charlestown, Massachusetts and worked as a nurse. In 1860, she made the historically groundbreaking decision to go to medical school and was accepted into the New England Female Medical College. And to give some context, this is 2 years before the Emancipation Proclamation. And in 1860, there were only 300 women out of 54,543 physicians in the United States. She became the first African-American female physician upon graduation in 1864. Soon after, she married her second husband, Arthur Crumpler. Her first husband had passed away about a year earlier. Arthur had been born into slavery in Virginia, but at the outset of the Civil War, he escaped to Union lines. He worked for 8 months as a blacksmith for the Union Army before making his way north to Boston in 1862. After Rebecca's graduation in 1864, she began a medical practice around that time, and she married Arthur in 1865. At the close of the Civil War, they felt compelled to move to the South. I wish there were more accounts of this time, as I have to imagine it was quite challenging. Dr. Crumpler had the support of the Freedmen's Bureau for the state of Virginia, but she also faced near-constant racism and sexism. Nevertheless, she persisted. In Richmond, Virginia, she found, as she put it, a proper field for real missionary work and one that would present ample opportunities to become acquainted with the diseases of women and children. During my stay there, nearly every hour was improved in that sphere of labor. The last quarter of the year 1866, I was enabled to have access every day to a very large number of the indigent and others of different classes in a population of over 30,000 colored.
4 years later, in 1869, the Crumplers returned to Boston and settled in a predominantly African-American neighborhood on Joy Street on the north slope of Beacon Hill. She describes this time, saying, "I returned to my former home, Boston, where I entered into the work with renewed vigor, practicing outside and receiving children in the house for treatment, regardless, in a measure, of remuneration." In 1880, she moved to the town of Hyde Park, which is now a neighborhood of Boston, and retired from practice. In 1883, she wrote a book titled A Book of Medical Discourses in Two Parts, which covers treating the cause, prevention, and cure of infantile bowel complaints from birth to the close of the teething period, or after the fifth year. Also, the cause, prevention, and cure of many of the most distressing complaints of women and youth of both sexes. The book is thought to be the first medical text by an African-American author and is dedicated to mothers, nurses, and all who may desire to mitigate the afflictions of the human race. In it, she gives a summary of her career. It may be well to state here that, having been reared by a kind aunt in Pennsylvania, whose usefulness with the sick was continually sought, I early conceived a liking for and sought every opportunity to relieve the sufferings of others. Later in life, I devoted my time, when best I could, to nursing as a business, serving under different doctors for a period of 8 years, from 1852 to 1860. Most of the time, at my adopted home in Charlestown, Middlesex County, Massachusetts. From these doctors, I received letters commending me to the faculty of the New England Female Medical College, whence, 4 years afterward, I received the degree of Doctress of Medicine. Dr. Crumpler died in 1895 and is buried in the Fairview Cemetery in Hyde Park, just a few minutes from our house.
In contrast to Rebecca, we know a good amount about her husband, Arthur Crumpler, through an article written about him in the Boston Globe in 1898, complete with a sketch of him. The article, titled Boston's Oldest Pupil, focused on Arthur's pursuit to become literate after Rebecca's passing. He had depended on her for reading and writing, and told the reporter, "When she passed away, I found that I should have to depend on myself if I wanted to learn anything. I could not read the newspapers during the last war, but if we have a war now, I shall be able to read all about it myself. I can do my own signing, and I am not making any more crosses."
If anyone wants to find out more about Dr. Crumpler, you can check out the show notes at hubhistory.com/018. We'll post a scan of our 1883 book on family medicine. We usually try to bring you a variety of primary sources, but Dr. Crumpler left very little behind. There isn't even a picture of her to share, but we will link to an explanation of the picture that's usually identified as her. We'll also include a profile on Arthur Crumpler. After learning that the Crumplers are buried in Fairview Cemetery in our neighborhood, I walked over there this morning to take a picture of their headstones. However, after working out the grid system and comparing it with their burial records, I realized that their graves are unmarked. In the show notes, we'll share copies of the burial records for Arthur and Rebecca Crumpler and a picture of the grassy plot where they are namelessly interred. If you have any information about how to get a headstone added to a Boston burying ground, or if you'd be interested in contributing to a crowdfunding campaign to help memorialize America's first black female physician, drop us a line.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're at Hub History on Twitter and at facebook.com/hubhistory. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. And while you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a show we're calling A Tale of Two Hermits, about John Gatley, the Hermit of Hyde Park, and Anne Windsor Sherwin, the Hermit of Boston Harbor.